This evening, I'm going to talk about, well, I'm asked to talk about early Buddhism to the actual change, evolution of teaching from the different layers of history. Now, this is a huge topic. This is a very, very huge topic. And one that some of you are familiar with in terms of the history. But for many Buddhists, I think we don't spend enough time trying to understand history. There's a lot of value in that, but it can be a very difficult thing to do. Actually, how many of you have read, looked up, tried to get to know, research, Google even, the history of Buddhism? Okay, quite a number of you. Great. This evening, to provide a context in terms of how I structure the talk, I don't come to you as a historian. I don't come to you as a scholar. I come to you as a Dharma practitioner over a number of years who is trying to make sense of how big the Buddha's teachings are. When I grew up in Malaysia, which is a Buddhist country. Well, the area that I was in is a Buddhist area. It's really an Islam or Muslim country. But where I'm at, I'm based in Penang, and there's a pretty strong Buddhist area within Malaysia. And growing up, I was exposed to various different forms of Buddhism. And that contributed to the richness of my understanding from a very lived experience of Buddhism. Grew up as Buddhist, went to temples a few times in a year, got to know a bit more, got to learn a little bit more. But from a kind of very traditional traditionalist way of understanding Buddhism. And Malaysia is also an interesting place whereby there are different types of Buddhism that's taken root there. You've got those from Thai Buddhist Burma tradition of Buddhism that's there. There's also the Chinese Buddhism that's actually there. Those are my two key roots of where I actually trained. Of course, there are the Tibetan Buddhists that also took root there. So essentially, all the different schools are pretty well represented in the area I grew up in. And I was fortunate enough to get to know a number of teachers, all from the various different schools, and to hear them teach, to attend talks, to go to centers. One thing that struck me was how different they can be. You go to a Thai temple, you go to a Chinese Buddhist temple, you go to a Tibetan temple, it looks and feels quite different. What you see, what you hear, the practices that they do, all quite varied from one another. That's why growing up, it was always a little bit of a niggling sense at the back of my mind. It's like, if all of them say that they're practicing Buddhism, why is it that they're so different from one another? And it wasn't until I came over to Australia, which is also another very good place to learn Buddhism, because this is also another place that Buddhism has, in its different form, has taken roots. Even here in Unibuds, I mean, years back I was part of Unibuds. And being a non-sectarian Buddhist organization, you get teachers from different streams, different schools, Zen background, you've got Thai patrons, you've got Chinese Buddhist teachers, you've got Tibetan teachers come in. Again, that real melting pot of Buddhism that I was exposed to and continue to refine my teaching, my learning in the Dharma, that curiosity and that confusion to some degree continued to bubble along until I came across the material around history of Buddhism, because I never really thought of going to trace back as to understanding the history. Because to be fair, in traditional Buddhist teachings or context of teaching, we don't typically talk much about history. Until you really seek for this type of information through scholarly works, through some teachers who particularly emphasize on the understanding of history, it's actually hard to come across anyone who talk or teach openly about history of Buddhism. And we'll come to the reason why in a bit. But I was lucky enough to come across a few teachers who emphasize this, that it is important to make sense of your experiences and your exposure is to understand how this teaching from one teacher, a very great teacher, over 2,500 years ago. From that one teacher, how did it continue to evolve and manifest the Buddhism that we have today. If you look at the congregation of Buddhist monastics, that means monks and nuns, ordained individuals from different traditions, you see that they all have different colors. Right? You've got the gray colored robes, you've got the maroon color, you've got the orangey color, you've got the yellows. They're actually quite colorful. And Buddhism in that way right now is captured in the colorfulness and the richness of that. But in that process as well, for one who is navigating and trying to understand and practice Buddhism, it can be also confusing experience. I don't know whether it is a unique experience on my part, or is it something that you also share? Any of you ever thought of how or why they're so different? Was it just me? Yeah.
Maybe you too.
Just everything, the color, the differences, the richness of it. Anyone? Okay, all right. Okay, so I guess that's why you're here for this talk, eh? So when I started to delve into the history of Buddhism, it started to become clearer and clearer to me. And this is a material I've got back a few times over my years of learning, practicing, and right now also teaching Dharma, teaching Buddhism. And each time I go back, I learn something more because there's more information. That this is not something that is set in stone. Sometimes when we think of history, we think that there's a very clear line. This happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. Yeah? When we learn history in school or university, right, we learn that, well, actually not so much in university, usually in high school. We learn that there's a clear path. This happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, this happened. Is that correct? It's a sequence of events that is quite factual in its sense. It's like a story, a narrative that started from one point in time and then end up at a certain point. So you look at history of modern history, you look at a medieval period, things like that, you've got a different points. But when you really appreciate and understand the study of history, you know that it's actually not that simple. Right? Each scholar, each person that tries to understand or put forward a position takes a particular narrative, a particular description of how things evolve, how things happen. And in Buddhism, it's much harder also to trace back its histories because there's so much material, and material is still currently being found. Until today, there are still old scriptures from hundreds of years ago that are still being discovered as we speak, in places like Afghanistan, the Silk Road, right, in caves and things like that. Sometimes we discover new scriptures. And sometimes they're in such language that no one really knows how to interpret it. But there are a few people around the world, and including some of the academics from Sydney University, for example, they get called in to actually look at certain types of script because these are very archaic script to how to interpret that. So these things are still happening as we speak. So it's not such a simple idea to say that, right, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. However, it is still useful for us to get an overall sense of how things flow. What was the actual likely story? What were the different factors that came in to contribute to the richness of Buddhism that we have today? The Theravada, the Mahayana, the Vajrayana. So this evening, I'm going to take you through a very short journey through history of about 2,500 years. We're trying to squeeze all that in about 15 minutes or so. Right? We'll see how we go. Right? And like I say, this is part of my own study looking at various different sources. Firstly, the Western scholastic movement. We have a lot to thank as traditional Buddhists or practicing Buddhists to those non-Buddhists who are scholars who actually look at the Buddhist texts and actually research and study it. In fact, some of the most believable sources come from these people because they are not invested in a particular area. Right? They are scholars looking at wording, to look at textual analysis, which one came earlier, this how language seems to be a bit later, right? Archaeological findings, right? Dating, carbon dating of scriptures and things like that. So there is that part of information. There is also another body of literature which is from the Chinese schools, whereby there are certain scriptures that's more available in the Chinese schools. So that's why there are also Chinese scholars and /Japanese scholars who have been studying the different parts of the scriptures within Asia. Right? So if you actually look closely at what they conclude, they sometimes conclude things are quite different because the sources are different. It is only in the recent years that these type of sources are starting to talk to each other. Because the Chinese are looking at the Chinese old scriptures, the Japanese are looking at the Chinese end partly in Japanese scriptures, usually the Chinese scriptures still, right? And then the Western ones typically look at the Pali scriptures, right? So different language, different canons, different scriptures as available. It is only in more recent times that there's starting to be a little bit more integration, right? Because one source is starting to be translated to another, and there are more scholars now who are multilingual than before. Even about 20, 30 years ago, even 50, like, there weren't that many scholars who were able to actually do both, right? Or have such close colleagues that they can actually help each other to understand certain scripture. If I don't understand Pali, then I need someone to actually interpret Pali. I might understand some Chinese, but the archaic Chinese needs someone who specializes in that area. Until you have collaboration, it's hard that you know and speak together. Having said so, it's useful for us to take a journey back, like I say, about 2,500 years ago, to see what actually happened. The time of the Buddha, since his death, and all the way passing down to where we have today. Is that okay? Alright. So this is history on steroids. Take a gear forward. So, the Buddha was actually a historical figure. Let's get this right. He did exist, and to be honest, I only found this out about late high schoolish, that the Buddha is actually a historical figure. Before that, he seems like a god in some far, far away place, that during times of need, I will put joss sticks or incense, light candles, and ask for protection. Right? And as you can see, for someone who grew up with that narrative, that part of view of Buddhism, the Buddha was far away. But you can see how that became the case. But he's a historical figure about 2,500-600 years ago. Now, when we look at history, plus and minus 200 years is actually quite common, right? When we look at before the Common Era, which is before the year 2017, right now, before that time, right, about 400 to 500 years, that time, some of these are not very clearly written, right? Depends on which area of the world, there are different inscriptions, different scriptures, different records that is actually available. As far as Buddhism is concerned, during the time of the Buddha, when it was specifically, it's about 2,500 years, plus and minus 200 years. Right? So about 2,003 to 2,700 years ago. Right? He lived in the northern part of India. He was the prince of not of a large kingdom, but a small state, right? In the northern part of India, which is currently in the Bihar state. So, in the northern part towards Nepal, that area. So, he grew up, saw the pain and suffering in life, and wondered, how is it that we can be rid of pain and suffering? And he renounced, let go of his throne, right, and went in search of spiritual enlightenment. Right? So, this is the basic building block of his life, and he, through his own efforts, through training his mind, cultivating the qualities of his mind, and then using those qualities of stability and clarity of his mind to actually cut through and really examine and investigate the nature of existence, that outcome of that is what we currently call enlightenment. The realization of, this is what life is about. This is how pain arises. This is how to be free of it. He spent about 45 years of his life then teaching around the northern parts of India. Yeah? And then, at the age of about 80 years old, again, plus and minus, we don't know, roughly we have a sense that around them, he lived to quite an old age because he had sickness, he had like back pain and things like that. So he was very human, he was a very human teacher, albeit very powerful mind that he had. Right? A strong mind, a real deep understanding about humanity, the nature of experience, a very strongly cultivated mind in its ability to analyze things, to be able to see things, to be able to teach and guide people, to be free from pain and suffering in one's life. Yeah. So at the age of about 80 years old, he died. And when he died, he didn't actually appoint a particular successor. He didn't say that right now, the leadership is now passed on to so and so. In fact, he was asked, like, once you're gone, is there someone that we can go to? Who's the next boss, so to speak? I said, nope, there's no one. You rely on two things, the Dhamma and the Vinaya. The Dhamma means, usually translated as his teaching, right? The teaching that he's given, the Dhamma, right? The teachings of the Buddha. The Vinaya are usually what are the actual codes or disciplines for the monastics That's one translation. But really, if you look at it, it's really how you apply the Dhamma. How do you live, right? And his focus was a lot on the monastic, the those who have renounced, given up the worldly life, the monks and the nuns. And therefore, a lot of his teaching was collated by these individuals, teachings towards the monks and for the nuns. So the Dhamma is his teaching, Vinaya is how you apply the teaching as monastics, right? So that's why if you look at the earliest part of the scriptures, early parts of the records, there is this, can I rub some of these up?
Yeah, that's fine.
So the Dhamma and Vinaya, he says that use these as your guide. I'm not appointing anyone. I've already spent 45 years teaching to you everything that I have. There is no closed fist here. He actually said that. He said, I've held nothing back. I've given you every single thing that I have. Therefore, rely on what I teach you in terms of what the teachings are and how to apply. Use that as your guide. Right? So when he died, and this was around roughly 500 BCE, before the Common Era. Yeah. The disciples, upon his death, got together, right, because there was a funeral, a pretty big funeral. And we know that a lot of the kingdoms, the kings around those areas came, a lot of political leaders came, a lot of lay people came, but also his key main disciples also came to send him off, essentially, right, to mark his death. And on the way, it was one of his chief disciples by the name of Mahakashyapa. So this is a monk who has been with the Buddha for a long, long time, who is highly practiced, highly realized. Right? And on his way to the funeral, he heard one of the monks, of the junior monks on his way to the Buddha's funeral, he heard him say that, oh, now that, something along the lines that now that the Buddha is gone, there's no one there to tell us what to do, what not to do, therefore, we can pretty much have free flow, right? So essentially, I'm paraphrasing, but you get what I mean. Yeah, saying that, well, the boss is gone, so then there's no one to look over us, we can do whatever we want. So Mahakashyapa, as he was going to the funeral, that was what he heard. And he knew that, see, even before the body of the teacher is being cremated, there's already this happening. Yeah, people are already thinking that way. Therefore, it is important for us, at the death of the Buddha, to come together to actually make sure we preserve his teachings in the best way possible. And historically, and we've got various different records of this, is after the death of the Buddha, so this is the death, or what we call Mahaparinibbana. About 3 months after that, so after the funeral, Mahakashyapa decided to say, well, since all of us are here, the teacher has died, it's been cremated, cremation has happened, let's all get together and then let's recite together what we understand and remember are his teachings so that we maintain and preserve the purity of the teachings. Yeah? How many of you know about this incident of the First Council? All right, a few. How many of you this is the first time you're hearing about a First Council taking place. Great. Okay. So, this is a historical event. And even in the current various different schools of Buddhism, in fact, all of the various different schools have records in one form or another that this council actually took place. Now, there are slight differences in terms of how big, who was there, and things like that, like details, but there was a sense that it was pretty clear that a meeting of a quite a large nature took place after within about 3 months after the death of the Buddha. Right? The number that was given was about 500. Now, in understanding the language, the archaic languages of India, it is that 500 is like a figure. It's like we say a few, a couple, you know? Really, a couple means two, right? A few means three. Right, but we don't use it in such strict context. Huh? A few people, it means like, you know, 3 to 6, 7, a few people, right? Or some people could mean a few people is like 2 to 3.
So in the past, 500 means like quite a large number of people. Yeah. So it said that about 500 of them, so quite a number of them, got together and then chaired by Mahakashyapa. And then there's Upali and Ananda. Now these were all very known figures that were very close to the Buddha. Upali is known for knowing a lot about the Vinaya, the application, and the rules pertaining to the monastics. What monks and nuns should and should not be doing, right? How do they need to conduct their life. He's particularly good in that. Ananda is actually the Buddha's cousin before he became a monk. He was the attendant for the Buddha for the most of his time. The Buddha had a number of attendants when he ran around, someone to just help him with his balls or whatever it is, to attend to his needs. Now Ananda was the one who served him the longest, and he was the attendant for the last bit of the Buddha's life, right? And I can't remember how long it is, but probably over like 10 years or something like that. Yeah. So therefore, he had got a very privileged position of what? If you're the attendant of the teacher, what privilege do you have?
You're the teacher.
That's right, right? Because you're always near the teacher. Whenever he teaches, you are there, right? You're waiting to see whether the teacher needs anything. So by association, by where you are physically, you're always there. Yeah? So whenever the Buddha taught, Ananda, in the later part of his life, whenever he taught, Ananda was most of the time there. Yeah? Sometimes he had to run errands and things like that. So between the three of them, plus the other 497 monks, let's say, right? Roughly about 500 of them. They all sat down and said, all right, let's work through. So what did the Buddha teach? So Ananda was the one, so Upali was the one, sorry, to say that these are the precepts, these are the rules, these are the applications set down by the Buddha. Ananda was the one who said these are the Dhamma part of it, which is the Buddha at this time, taught at this place, this is what he taught. If you look at Buddhist scriptures, they always begin with, thus I have heard. Yeah, and usually I means Ananda, because he was around a lot of time. So we have to remember, about 2,500 years ago, there is no written tradition. There's no someone that sit down there and say, all right, let's write it down like meeting minutes. There was no meeting minutes back then, right? What there was an oral tradition, which means when the teacher teaches you something, then you try to remember, all right, this is the list, these are the things I need to remember. That's oral tradition. So during that meeting, when they all got together, there was a checking of Ananda was saying, all right, I have heard at this time, at this country, in this village, the Buddha taught, and these were the people present, right? And then he taught these things. If the people are present, most probably within the 500, right, you were there, is it verified? Yes, all right, correct, this is what the Buddha taught, so this is correct. So they started an oral tradition to preserve the Buddha's teachings. Because again, there's no writing. The earliest writing in human history, in fact, based on at least some historian, we don't know yet, we might discover more. What is the earliest human writing that we know of? Actually, no, that's not the right question. What do you think that document was? The earliest writing?
Sumerian tablets.
Yes. What were they?
Clay tablets.
Yes. What was written there?
It's a stone that they carved for all the law.
Yep.
Not law.
It's
accounting
stuff. It was tax. Yeah. So writing was more the area of the tax collectors, right? Spiritual part. Firstly, they do not write because they think that it's very important to keep it in one's heart, not written down. Because writing is administration, is government, and in fact is tax collectors, right? So that's why there's no written tradition at that time. But there's an oral tradition, which is whatever that has been told to you, remember it with all your heart. That's the recitation. That's why we still, until today, do the chanting of Buddhist scriptures, yeah? We go to temples, we chant the Buddha's words, or we chant certain types of things, so that we remember and keep it in our hearts that way. So this was what happened. During the first council, 500 of them sat down and said, all right, let's collect a set of teachings. Right? So this is the material one, let's call it. Yeah. Now, scholars today pretty much agree that we do not know what M1 is. It's lost. We don't have a sense of what the material of M1 is exactly But there is a way of us trying to trace back as to what the material is. And we'll come back to this point in a bit. Right? How are we going so far? Any questions? Right. Some of you, this is new stuff. Some of you, this is revision. Yeah. So let's hear where the story goes. All right. Now, at this point, the Buddhism at that time, right, was very popular in that area. Like I say, during the death of the Buddha, quite a number of key political figures were there, kings and things like that were there. So clearly, they actually had pretty good standing. Yeah. However, the death of the Buddha was a huge blow. Because he was there for 45 years, being able to guide the group of monastics practicing and lay people, laymen, laywomen, right? He was seen as a figurehead, and if there's anything wrong, they can go back to him to check. I've heard so-and-so said these things. Is this true? And you will see in the scriptures, the Buddha sometimes say, no, that is the incorrect view. I have not made that proclamation, right? And so has ascribed this to me. No, this is not what I have said. If you want to look at that, one scripture that's useful to look at, you can Google this, is the lion's roar, right? The lion's roar scripture, or the sutta, right? Because at one time, even in the late part of Buddha's life, because his group got bigger and bigger, it was sometimes quite difficult to manage everyone who is, to make sure everyone is on the same page. And so that's why when you can see when he died, these concerns were actually there. This risk of actually the loss of the preservation was potentially there. Yeah. Before he died, the number of years before he died, that was where the lion's roar scripture is. And that is when he said that, no, I do not teach these things that are being ascribed to me. These are my actual teachings. It's like a lion's roar. This is what my truth is, not what they claim to be. So he actually clarified those things. Yeah. But when he died, his students say that it's important for us to get together and then put things down. But N1, we don't know what it is now. Yeah? Because what has happened is, this is an oral tradition, so it is sometimes a problem with that is that it can sometimes be a little bit plus minus, right? Accuracy sometimes can go missing a little bit. Yeah? As much as there is a great community to be able to recite together, and the Buddha said, three monastics to a community. You should not go with less than three people. Three or four, I can't remember. That means you need to always be with someone else to practice together. Yeah? And to call yourself a community. So that you can keep each other in check. So that in the recital, in the oral tradition, you can keep each other in check, because when you recite together, you will know that it sounds the same or it doesn't sound the same. Yeah? Now, what then happened was, this is the first council, and then after that, about 60 to 80 years after that, right? So this is about 500 BCE. This is about second council is about 350 BCE. Now, some scholars say 60 to 80 years, some say about 100 years, but like I say, with history, plus and minus 200 years is give or take. Yeah. So what essentially happened was that because Buddhism continued to spread more and more, right? Because they were given a lot of support, it continued to take root because of the steering of these senior monks like that and senior nuns at that time as well, great political support, it continued to spread wider and wider and wider. Then what happened was that as one spreads, right, the teaching spreads, the numbers spread, with a large family, with a large group, it's harder to have standardization, right? Some people move to certain areas, some people move this way, and then they started to have differences in terms of how they practice, in terms of the Vinaya, how they apply, which can come down to sometimes certain rules pertaining to monks, like whether or not one should be handling, is it okay to take money instead of taking alms, which is traditionally food, for example. Right, in some areas, maybe it's a bit hard to get food, but if devotees or people give money instead, is it okay to receive that? Right? During this time, in the first council, they say that anything that is the Buddha had created in terms of the precepts for the monastics, we keep exactly as it is. Let's not make any changes. Right? The Buddha, before his death, did tell Ananda, it is okay for some of the smaller things to actually change a little bit, but the big precepts, the big things like no killing, things like that, that should always stay the same. But the small things like whether or not, well, actually, he didn't, That was another issue. The Buddha told Ananda, small precepts you can change, but the large one, don't change it. Right? So when Ananda went to the first council, the elders asked him, so which are the big and which are the small precepts? Ananda said, I didn't ask. Right? So they said, all right, in this case, let's maintain exactly the same. Right? However many rules or applications that the Buddha said in terms of how you conduct your life as a monastic, let's keep exactly the same. But about 100 years later, as it continued to evolve, the differences in terms of things like that, whether we can handle money or not, whether we can even keep salt, there's actually a rule, right, that monastics are not meant to keep salt with them. Right? They take whatever alms that has been given to them, they don't change anything, they don't add salt or pepper and take out their shakers, nothing of that. You just take whatever is given to you because it's part of their practice. You just take whatever has been given to you and you observe whatever arises as you practice. Right? So one of the things that are possibly the small things is like not being able to keep salt. But we don't know whether there's a big or a small precepts. As you can see, after 100 years, as they move into different areas, different groups start to have their little different changes. Yeah, and there's a talk, and some of the scholars have said that there's a, between the West and the East. The Eastern and the Western communities are starting to practice differently. So that when a member from one community goes to the other, they're like, well, hang on, this is not how we do things. And then from this community, they go there, it's like, well, hang on, this is not how we do things. So there start to be tension. Is it meant to be like that? Is it meant to be like that? So this started to happen about 100 years after that. So what happened was that because of all these differences in opinion pertaining to the Vinayas, a decision was made to have... Let's call another council. Right? Again, these are the two which all Buddhist traditions that is relevant and exist today. There's no difference in opinion. Or both say that these two did exist. Yeah? Now this happened with about 700 of people, 700 monastics coming together to say, let's work this out. Right? There's something that's not quite right here. We are not standardized right now. Let's work this out, what's actually going on. There were 10 matters of the Vinaya we were debated, things like eating food afternoon, like very traditional is after 12, don't eat, right? Until the next day, right? The sun goes down, when the sun comes back up again, that's when you can eat until 12 o'clock again, and then you don't, right? So the rules like this were debated, right? So some say that because East and West, some say that, oh, it's okay from 12 until 1 o'clock, it's okay. Some say maybe a light dinner, for example, is okay, but not too heavy. So differences in opinion, so that they debated in the second council. They debated usually issues around the Vinaya, right? But then the issue is that not everyone agreed, right? Here there's agreement because the Buddha died not too long ago. So everyone agreed, yes, the teachings, yes, the application and the rules and the precepts are there. They all agreed. But here, after about 100 years, they can't quite agree. As to some say, really, after 12, do you have to be that pedantic? Maybe after a little bit, it's okay. As long as the sun is up, it's still okay. Or maybe a light dinner is okay. Things like that. I'm not exactly saying what those issues are, but you get the idea, right? Those issues that are different. So this is the start whereby they're starting to see some difference in opinion. And in some ways of looking at... This is the first schism. Schism means a split. Yeah, in one organization, it becomes a separation. Yeah, and usually it's like let's say a church within that separates into two churches. Right, in the Buddhist group, one Buddhist community separates to two different Buddhist communities. This is when it's usually seen as the time whereby the schism actually happened. The problem here is that this is to do with the Vinaya. As far as the Dhamma itself, it is a sense that there's not too much disagreement as to what the Buddha taught. It is more a disagreement of how you apply it as monastics. Yeah? So this is we're not sure, to be fair. Even scholars these days say that it looks like they will have pretty good agreement on this, but differences in opinion in this. However, around this time also, so this is when it starts to split, yeah? Different groups. There are two groups that actually started to come up, which is based on, depending on which document you look at, there is a sense that there were two groups that split. There's a group where they said, don't change anything. Still go back to what the first council agreed, which was what the early Vinaya is. Let's stay the same. This considered the more conservative group, right? Staviravada typically means the more elder, right? In Chinese, it's those who have the highest seat. So in Buddhism, if the longer you're ordained as a monk or a nun, you're considered more senior. So typically when they sit in that order. Those who have been ordained for longer, those who ordained later, they go by the seniority. So Staviravada means the highest seat. That means those who are more elder, who have been around for a long time. Mahasanghika means the greater community, right? So there's a split in between the different types of ideology. So these ones say that let's maintain to be more conservative. These ones say that maybe it's time for us to move with the changes. Right? We don't have to be so specific and so pedantic about some of these rules. Yeah. Now, if you look at, depend on the sources, if you look at these sources, they say that they are the ones who actually changed. They kept original. But if you look at the sources here, they say that they kept original, but they have actually changed. There is some controversy there as well. Yeah, so to be fair, I'm just giving you disclaimers as I go, right? But the main thing is that there is a sense of a separation in terms of disagreement as to how the rules pertaining to monks and nuns should be actually applied. And within that as well, this is when the period and the start of. Sectarian Buddhism. Here is, this period is early Buddhism. During the Buddha's time, it's early original Buddhism, and it is around here that what we call the period of sectarian Buddhism, whereby there are different sects that start to actually arise. Yeah? During this time as well, there are also different ideas in the differences in the Dharma started to arise. Right? Remember I said that what called the second council was more this. But then there was also starting to be differences in opinion even in the Dhamma itself. During the Buddha's time, if you are fully realized, right, if you follow the Buddha's teaching, you see for yourself the truth that the Buddha has seen, you reach the level of liberation as the Buddha has, you are known as an
Arahant,
right? And the Arahant's liberation, the purity of the mind is equal to the purity of the Buddha. That's why, in some traditions, they call the Buddha the great Arahant. Right? For example, in modern day Theravada, the most basic way that we will apply the Buddha is Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato. Right? So we are venerating the Buddha, who is the great teacher, who has come, who has seen and come back. And the one who is an Arahant. So the same is like equal in terms of their liberation, the purity of the mind. Right? So early Buddhism, Arahant and Buddha, similar liberation. Although one is the teacher, one has more skillful means, the Buddha is able to teach much better, be able to understand, be able to explain things much clearer, and he's the one that based on his own effort, no one taught him, he found the path. But based on that, he taught others to see the same truth. Seeing the truth-wise is the same, yeah, between the Arahant and the Buddha. But around sectarian Buddhism, there is also a notion that whereby there are certain groups whereby they're starting to say, well, maybe the Arahant is not as great as the Buddha. Maybe they're not as perfect. Right? And that's why there were five theses that were put forward. Right, by someone called Mahadeva. We don't know whether this is an actual historical figure or not. But what suggests to us is that there is a sense of a query that maybe the position of the Arahant is not that great, it's not that perfect. Right? In that Arahants will still have some doubts, right? They're not perfect. In fact, the five things, they're subject to some temptation still. Right, they're not fully, they don't have perfect knowledge because they have to ask for directions as to where to go, things like that. Right? In some ways, to try to erode the position of the Arahant. Right? So you can see that in terms of the Dhamma itself, it's starting to also change here. Right? Things are starting to actually be a bit different. The Vinaya has changed, but also the Dhamma starts to change. Now, this is an important issue because if there's a split, in the Buddhist tradition, if you're monastic, then you're always in the new moon, full moon, and the quarter periods. That means about 2 to 4 times in a month, you need to come together as a community, right, to do the, what they call uposatha meeting, which is they then read through and they go through the Vinaya, these are our rules. Has anyone done anything wrong in this period of time? If there is, you will confess, you acknowledge that you've done something wrong, right? And then they'll say that usually, they call it some level of checks and balances, yeah? All of us come together, we recite what we uphold together, and anyone has actually broken any rules, if there is, we acknowledge that. Now, if there's a difference in the opinion in terms of what the Vinaya actually is, then you can't come together as one community anymore. So what happens? They split. You do your recitation, we do our recitation. Yeah? Because in our group, we say that part of our rule is not to eat after noon, for example. The other one says not to eat, I don't know, after sunset, for example. Yeah, that's not true. I'm just making it up. But to describe to you the difference. But because the recitation is different, so that's why you can't meet together. What happens is they start to differentiate from each other. Because of that, new ideas can also come up, which can not necessarily be standardized across the different groups. Yeah, you start to see that they're not coming together, meeting as much, so these different ideas can start to arise. This sectarian Buddhism is also a period whereby they call Abhidhamma Buddhism. When the Buddha's death, there was the Dhamma and the Vinaya. How many of you have heard of the term Tripitaka? Okay. What does Tripitaka mean? Apart from not the monkey, the CUG, the journey to the west monk called Tripitaka, not that one, but what does Tripitaka in Buddhism usually refer to? Not that one. What does Tripitaka typically refer to?
Come on, it's an actual event, right? Journey to the west, but it's not monkey, but...
Yeah, but what does the actual word mean? What does Tripitaka actually mean?
Three baskets.
Three baskets. Three baskets of what? So you're correct. Three baskets, Tripitaka. Three. Pitaka. So three baskets. Three baskets of what?
Teaching.
Yes. So usually in modern days, when we say Tripitaka, it usually means, in short, Buddhist scriptures right now, yeah? And it means that there are three different sets of Buddhist scriptures. What do you guess they are, the different sets?
Abhidhamma.
The Mahayana will have the Mahayana Tripitaka, the Theravada will have the Theravada Tripitaka, right? And one of that in there is Abhidhamma. Pali Canon itself is Tripitaka. The Pali Tripitaka, you got the Chinese Tripitaka, you got the Tibetan Tripitaka as well. Everyone has got their different set. But they all have three different sets because they got Dhamma, Vinaya, and Abhidhamma. You see something similar here and something similar there. Modern scriptures in different schools typically call their scriptures Tripitaka. There are three categories of writings that we have. One pertaining to the teaching, one pertaining to the precept and application, and the third one is the expansion of this, right? Which is like, this gives you the general ideas, this one breaks things down much more. Yeah? Sorry? Much more detail. However, if you ask some Buddhist traditions even today, you ask them, where did the Abhidhamma come from? They'll tell you that the Buddha taught them. They say that Abhidhamma comes from the Buddha, right? Anyone who is more modern teachings, look at the scholastic work, the teachers will tell you, this, yes, from the Buddha, this from the Buddha, this, a bit later from the Buddha. Because the Abhidhamma didn't come out until this period of time, which is after, about 100-150 years after the death of the Buddha. During the death of the Buddha, there was only Dhamma and Vinaya. That's why the Buddha says, rely on Dhamma and Vinaya. First council, second council, all different schools agree that There was the Dhamma and the Vinaya. There's no mention of the Abhidhamma. Abhidhamma only came out when the different sectarian Buddhism, they start to split into different groups. Typically, we call it the split of about 18 to 20 groups. Right? They start to split over like 50 or a few hundred years. This is the sectarian Buddhism period. Each group then started to compose like a commentary on the teachings itself, which is what they call Abhidhamma, a higher Dhamma. In the way they consider higher Dhamma is because it's more detailed. Yeah? But each group, they have probably, we don't have the scriptures these days, but we can guess there's probably about 18 to 20 versions of Abhidhamma, even back that long ago. Because each school will have their way, their interpretation of the early original teachings. Yeah? So this is the period also that scholars currently call Abhidhamma or sectarian Buddhism. How are we going so far? It starts to get complicated, isn't it? Yeah, the story from one source starts to now become more broad. Yeah? How are we going with time? Gosh, we have to speed up some more. Right.
So, what's the date of the second council?
This is about 350 BC. BCE. Yeah? So, death of Buddha 500, this is about 3 months after, so close to that period, and then this is about 100 years after that, 60 to 150 years after that. Yeah? And this period of time itself, sectarian Buddhism, went on, continued down different streams. I can show you a brief graph. You don't need to see exactly what it is, but can you see the picture? These are how many schools there were at that time, based on one set of recording. Another set of recording said there were this many. So as you can see, it's not so simple. It's not like there's only one big happy family together, right? They started to break off different areas based on geographical region where they were, based on how they approached some of the interpretation of the Dhamma. Yeah? Now, based on these different streams, various different things start to happen. Around 250 BCE, a great emperor arose in India. Who is that?
Ashoka.
In fact, before Ashoka, there is no unified India. He's essentially the first one, from his grandfather's work until his father and then to him, managed to eventually so-called unify the whole, these different small different states to be what we call modern day India, right? So he was the first one who was most successfully able to bring everyone together under what we call the Mauryan Empire, right? Which is also some translation is called the Peacock Empire, Peacock Dynasty. Yeah. So Ashoka unified India under the Mauryan Empire. Before that, there was a lot of turmoil. There were warring states and everything. He was the one who managed to essentially go and clear out everyone. He killed a lot of people. Yeah? And if you follow what his story is, that after all, he managed to unify India, he suddenly had this huge realization and said that, oh, I'm done killing. Right? It's just too much. And then turned to Buddhism. That's what history, one strand of history actually says. Right? But this is also where there's a greater stability around India now. Right, but previously it was more segregated. The other thing is that once Ashoka became the empire, the head of the empire of India, he then made one move, which is he chose Buddhism as the state religion. Now that everyone is unified, out of all different religions, he picked Buddhism for one reason or another as the state religion. That means the entire empire, this is the official religion. However, he's also a very integrative emperor. He knew that based on his conquer of so many different areas, they don't all believe the same thing. So he actually encouraged religious freedom at the same time. But he himself adopted Buddhism and pushed a lot of development of Buddhism, Ashoka. Because of that, Buddhism, before that, was still not that big. But this point, it went like, yeah? Like, because you got a huge empire and you got the backing of the emperor, the religion is going to grow, right? It's going to grow many, many fold. And because of that, what also occurred is that Buddhism became mass for everyone. Yeah? Because before that, it was still not, it's big, but it's still a lot of people who are practicing, it's in centers and things like that. But now Buddhism became the popular religion for everyone. And when there's more people in the religion, sometimes the quality can go down. Quantity goes up, quality can go down. Yeah? So sometimes you will see, even tutorial group. More tutorial group, better outcome. Now, tutorial group, we've got 3 times the number of students, it becomes like a lecture. We have to control each student's quality, yeah? So it's a bit similar like that. Buddhism became for the mass. And when it became for the mass, it also needed to adapt to the needs of the masses. Yeah? And that's where some of these teachings continue to evolve more and more. Right? So sectarian Buddhism, Abhidhamma Buddhism. Right? Ashoka, his contribution. He died around 230 BCE. Right, that's when he died. Now, he was a very powerful emperor. But his son and his generations further down were not like him. So the empire started to lose ground a little bit. Right, and then it was in 185 BCE, the Songha dynasty came up. And they favored Brahmanism, not Buddhism. You can see that politically it started to shift. Yeah? So here is the first time really that state and religion came together. Yeah? Previously, yes, there's a lot to do with Dhamma. There was a lot to do with monastics, monks and nuns. There were a lot of great people, including kings and queens, who supported the Dhamma, but they never interfered with the Dhamma. By Ashoka period, he's the first one who said that this is not the state religion. Therefore, he started to take an active involvement in how the affairs of the community were run. Right? Now, today, we see Ashoka as one of the beacons of Buddhism. He's the king, one of the first kings who were given, actually no, not the first kings, during the Buddha's time there were, but he's one of the biggest empire, head of empire that actually pushed Buddhism to the foreground. However, the flip side of that is that he interfered as a state. Right? The state and religion started to become closely related. If you read the story of Ashoka, it's actually very interesting. That in itself is probably another hour. But I'll give you a short, brief sense. During his time, there was said that there was, remember all this split that's starting to happen? There were groups that were, but they say that, look, I don't recognize those as Buddhist monks, right? So I'm not going to go and hang out with them. So there was this split in the community. Ashoka just unified the kingdom, but then as a state religion, Buddhism, but Buddhism in there, if there's tension, it's not going to go well. You know what I mean? You've worked so hard to unify India, and you use Buddhism as the state religion, but there are also different sects within the religion who is not seeing eye to eye. And because of that, there's tension. I don't recognize them. They say, I don't recognize you. This is not good for governance, right? So in the actual records, a few things happen. In some of the records, you will hear that Ashoka went in and got rid of all those who were actually bad monks and nuns, and forced them to disrobe, become lay people again, and purge, purify the community. You have a question?
Yes. So how did he know that they are bad? Until what?
Some said that he consulted with the most senior ones to say that, look, these people, this group said that these are the teachings. Do you agree or not? So he got one of the key person, you see this as a historical figure, Moggali Puttathissa. He got Thissa to come out. He's a senior monk in his own right, to come out to say that, look, this is right, this is not right. He got the senior ones to actually determine that. Right? Now, this is one account of it. So the current account whereby people tend to see Ashoka as a shining beacon, tend to say that Ashoka did a good thing by kicking out the ones who were the baddies, essentially. But if you look at some other records as well, he also said that there was a very interesting incident whereby when he is in the process of purging and purifying the community, one of his main ministers that he sent to actually do that, he went and said that, look, two groups, you don't get together. Ashoka said, you need to get together. Right? And then he said, no, they're not real Buddhists. Like, no, they are not real Buddhists. So the minister had no choice. He said that these are the emperor's words. You either do it or you don't. And if you don't, you die. Right? This was the minister. But it's actually recorded. What ended up happening is that they said no, still no. And then what he ended up was he started killing monks, one after another. Until...
Yes.
No. Until the person that came out was Ashoka's brother, who was a monk. Which is interesting. Why did the minister start killing a particular group when Ashoka's brother belonged to as well? Right? And if you look at some of the writing, it says that it is the elders that got killed. So there's different conflicting information here. This is where history gets murky. And also the plot thickens. Look, we won't know for clarity, but you can see that there is also potentially, when state and religion join, it could be a way of controlling the people and masses. But we don't know. I'm not here to judge Ashoka, because I'm not in the position to. But it goes back to us, when we look at history, we need to look at it with some level of skepticism, right? Healthy skepticism, right? And also some humility as well. Yeah. So don't take everything as it is, typically, right? So, to me, Ashoka did a lot of good. Because what happened is that after apparently getting off the baddies, Moggaliputta Tissa then established much more clearer guidelines and everything, and then Buddhism flourished. But it might have been also that he selected a particular branch of Buddhism and not another, we don't know. Right? Because there were differences in opinion. Which one that the king happened to favor, if it's the right one, great. But if it's the wrong one, thousands of years later, we're possibly still getting some issues and difficulty. Yeah? Okay. How are we going so far? Yeah? I find this interesting, so... Yeah?
Ashoka, are you quoting contemporary records, or...?
All records. All records.
I mean, were there written records for that time, too?
Yeah. Yeah, some of them, yeah. But there's some of them written after Ashoka, period. But there are also records of different scriptures from different groups that speak to some of these issues. Yeah? Remember, the way to... This is not necessarily the correct way, but the way to look at it is there are different sets of scriptures, but there are different schools, yeah? And different schools will have a different view about what Ashoka did. Right? Some will say, Ashoka did us a great thing, right? Of, you know, purging those who are not good. Some scriptures say that Ashoka actually, what he did was he even got boats with holes in it and then put the monks on them and then take them across the river. And it says that, well, if they're really that enlightened, they'll be able to fly, right? They'll be able to kind of escape with their supernatural abilities. Many were killed in that process too. And then there are different accounts, which is the killing until the brother stepped in. These are actual accounts from all teachings from there or some of the records, bits and pieces that we can put together these days. So that's why I say history is which line that you want to follow. And it's not as clear cut. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, I've been an archaeologist in England.
Yep.
And to have that detail from 250 BC seems...
Some of them were probably later too, right? And like I say, some of these were around here. And really, the scriptures that we have in the different schools right now, some of them date back to pretty early times. Yeah? Now, to be fair, not the full chunk of it. Sometimes like a Vinaya from a particular school, Dhamma from a particular school. Current modern day Theravada comes from, supposedly, one of the streams of the Stavarivada. Modern-day Mahayana movement comes from the Mahasanghika school, apparently. Yeah? But within the Mahayana canon, like the Chinese Buddhist Tripitaka, some of the scriptures in there also came from other groups. So this is where it gets even more complicated. If you look at the Chinese scriptures right now in its entirety, and there used to be a set up in the University of New South Wales Library, it is like a few shelves that big, right? And within that, there are collections from this school, some from other schools, so on and so forth, which is makes it a bit of a collection. It's not as clear cut, not like, oh, one of this became this, one of this became that. It's not, because you have different influences across as well. Yeah, the Tibetans have the Tibetan Tripitaka, the Chinese have the Chinese Tripitaka, the Burmese Thai with other Subhapura Bumi area have got their own collection as well, which is a Pali one, which is based on the Sinhalese Sri Lankan ones. Yeah, so you can see that it starts to get a little bit tricky. But this period of Abhidhamma and sectarian Buddhism is when it started to become more and more diverse. The different opinions start to arise. Yeah? Keep going? Alright. Then the plot thickens even more. Right? So, there's a period around, so this now comes out here. Around 1 century, the Common Era, which is what we call the rise of the Mahayana movement. Right? Up until this point, it is a lot to do with the Vinaya, how you do things, that some changes that start to take place in terms of the Dhamma. Around 1 century in the modern era, the current era, there's the rise of what we call the Mahayana movement. Now this is a movement whereby they start to be quite different from what the old teachings were. They started to add in more and more ideas that expand more and more from the earlier concepts of the Dhamma and Vinaya. Right? For example, it is said that the Mahasanghika, one of the schools that continued to flourish and continued to exist, because there were 18 to 20 schools, right? Within that, not all of them survived. Some of them, we just never know what they taught, because there's no scripture, there's no written records, nothing was actually remains anymore. Some with it, it got passed down. One of the streams of the Mahasanghika gave rise to the Mahayana movement. Now, some scholars agree that there might be one stream that came, but it is most likely that all these different groups within them, they started to emerge an idea of going back to the roots. What happened is here, because there's so many different opinions that's different, right? It becomes again too nitpicky. Is it this or is it that? Right? You're disagreeing in a lot of different things. Around this period of time, people started getting a bit sick of this. Like, there's just so much disagreement. Do we have to be that pedantic? Is it this? Is it that? Why don't we actually go back to live like the Buddha's time? And this is the essential seed that gave rise to the Mahayana movement. A few things happened. Firstly, because Buddhism became for the masses, so you need to have best distribution of religion. So this is also a period whereby Brahmanism, right, the Bhagavad Gita and things like that, in the Hinduist tradition, they became more and more formed as well, and became what we know currently as a Hindu religion. Now, Hinduism supposedly goes for as long as no one can remember. But based on its key scriptures that is currently around, which is around the Bhagavad Gita, let's see where that timeline is. 200 BCE. Around 200 BCE is where the Bhagavad Gita, which is a key scripture for modern day, current day Hinduism, that was when it was, scholars give or take 100 years or so, that is when it started to take its form. So you have Buddhism that became the mass. This so-called Hinduism was also for the masses. There's a lot of deities and things like that. There's a notion of this. Bhakti. Bhakti comes from, let's make it simple. Bhakti is a notion of a devotion to a supernatural power. Right? Devotion. That's what bhakti actually points to. The practice is a devotion to something that's bigger than you. Now, the notion of bhakti emerged both in Buddhism and in what we call Hinduism, Brahmanism at that time. So what happened is that the spirit of devotion started to come out. So bhakti and mass distribution of religion, the ingredients came together. What happened? Because now Buddhism is not so much about Four Noble Truths, all these things, five aggregates, six sense bases, which is very deep. It became a religion for everyone. Plus, there's a rise of this sense of devotion. The Buddha as a teacher, as a very highly realized teacher, became deified, became something like a god. Yeah? Because of this notion of bhakti. Now, a few reasons. Because one, Hinduism started to become popular, so Buddhism also changed to become something that you can use bhakti to actually approach Buddhism, which is what we see today, even the devotional practices. Yeah? Of when I was young, asking for the Buddha for protection or help when I got exams or something like that. That is from the basis of bhakti, a devotion to a large higher being. Up to this point, early Buddhism, there's no sense. You revere him as a teacher who is one who is fully enlightened, has so much wisdom, able to guide us out of the difficulties and distresses in life. But as time went on, various different factors, because of mass distribution and bhakti, right, he became a devotional figure. So the Buddha became less human-like and became more godlike. So this is one of the factors of the rise of the Mahayana movement. Yeah? The other point that caused the rise of the Mahayana movement is that the focus on compassion. Because again, too scholarly, too dry, too many arguments, right? Why don't we just get along? Why don't we just learn how the Buddha lived? He was, you know, he was with truth, but he was also a very warm, very caring type of a teacher. Let's go back to those qualities of compassion. That's another angle that led to the rise of the Mahayana movement, right? And then there's more. Based on that, different scriptures, suttas, started to get added onto the collection. Right? Over time, M1 is the smallest collection. Then you might have around here is M2. Now there's got M18 to 20. This one becomes M++. Yeah? So more and more scriptures started to be written and being ascribed to the Buddha, saying that these are his teachings. Yeah? So this is now becoming more and more problematic. Now, it's probably that they didn't do this out of trying to make something that's not there. It might be that because it's still an oral tradition, that's a large thing, right? Writing is still not that common. Yeah? By then, writing was starting to emerge more and more, but still not that common, right? Still oral tradition. The change, the start of bhakti, mass production, right? The focus on compassion, you almost need to rethink the whole of what Dhamma and Vinaya actually means. Yeah, so new ideas start to come up. All these ideas of early Mahayana typically comes from expansion of some of the things that the Buddha touched on. And here, there are two main schools that came up. Majjhimika or Majjhimaka, Vijayanada, Vijnanavada. Who has heard of things like this? Okay. Two things. The rise of Mahayana, mass, bhakti, devotion, and compassion. The other one is, in terms of how the philosophical understanding of the Buddha's teaching, that got expanded a little bit more. Majjhimika school is basically saying that, it's going to be hard to try to explain it very quickly. Essentially, Majjhimika school says that it focuses on emptiness. That actually, it is the world is empty on its own self. But the emphasis on the emptiness, the sunyata part, which is part of early Buddhism, that gets focused and emphasized a lot. In the Vijnanavada school, it is the emphasis on the consciousness. That is, everything is about consciousness. Right, everything of reality, there is no real reality outside but our sense of consciousness of that. Right? And you can see in Mahayana movement, in Mahayana scriptures, you can see the Yogacara scriptures are here, the the hard scripture, hard sutra, those are things that are a bit more like Majjhimika type of teaching, right? If you look at the Prajna Paramita Sutta, that's Majjhimika thinking, right? Yogacara Sutta, the Tao thinking, right? So these ideas start to, as society became more sophisticated, the philosophy of the Dharma also became more sophisticated. But this was not M1. This is already M++. Yeah, you can see from M1, it just keeps growing. That's why if you look at Mahayana Tripitaka these days, compared to, let's say, Theravada Tripitaka, the size is very different. Right? Theravada Tripitaka is about a tenth, 10% of the Mahayana Tripitaka. As you can see, the volume has actually increased that much more. Right? So this is what eventually occurred. Because of time, I will speed up even more. So this is about 1st century. And then this went on for about 250. Around then, what actually happened was Mahayana ideas became stronger in India itself. Alongside what was early on the Dhamma and the Vinaya. So you get more and more. There's a richness of information started to come up. Yeah? And then about 500 years common era to about 1,000 years common era, this is the period of from Mahayana, it became Tantric Buddhism, which is essentially the esoteric Buddhism, which is what we see a lot in modern day Tibetan Buddhism. Right? Now this, the focus here are a few things. Firstly, okay, let's see how we go. Remember, let's go back to the rise of Mahayana. They focus on bhakti, focus on compassion, focus on new sophisticated ideas. Yeah? So many different ideas of Mahayana started to rise. Again, what happened was, became too dry again. Because these two schools didn't agree with each other. The Yogacara school said that their view is the correct one, which is the Vijnana Mata. The Majjhimika school said that there's the correct view. Even within Majjhimika, they subsequently split into two different smaller areas within Majjhimika. Right? Those with Chinese understanding, this is Zhong Dao. Right? This is Wei Su. Right? So within here, they split, and then again, more discussion, more dry scholastic arguments has happened. So you can see, even within that period of time, within the 500 years that continued going on, same thing happened. Yeah? Practice became too much scholarly, too much argument, let's switch, again became too much, and then it gave rise to Tantric Buddhism, which gave back to saying that, look, we need to actually go back to something that's a little bit more applied again. So the characteristics of Tantric Buddhism are a few things. There are now even more different ways to achieve enlightenment. And these are very specific, relationally driven ways of giving information. That's why in Tantric Buddhism, the guru and the disciple relationship is very important, right? You need to have a guru to actually, or you have a teacher to actually pass down the esoteric, which is the secretive teachings, one pass from one to another. So the relational part, the community coming back together, that got re-emphasized. Right? In Tantric Buddhism as well, because of the location that it was spread towards places like India, northern part, kind of the tougher parts of some of these community were kind of rougher, more aggressive type. So some of the Buddhism that actually emerged from that also became much stronger. You can see that the evocation of Tibetan Buddhism, some of the deities are very strong. Right? You see like big teeth, huge eyes, things like that. Whereas in early Buddhism, you don't tend to see that motif. You don't tend to see that graphics. Right? So the focus here is that a lot of symbolism starts to emerge. Because also society became more sophisticated. Art became more, right, more subtle. Yeah. So ideas became stronger and stronger. Well, that's why we have Tantric Buddhism, which is, scholars agree, is about 500 to 1,000 years common era that it actually started to arise. Right? Because of time, I won't touch too much on that. I do want to give you a little bit of time to ask questions. After Tantric Buddhism, 10th century BC, this all still happened within India. Then, alright, sorry Buddha. Okay, let's go on a little bit more, and this will be the final piece. From here, starting from the 7th century, so about 700 to 1200 Common Era, India had gradual decline because of various influences. The various invasion or invasion attempts, right? By previously it was some of the Greek, but when the Greek came in, like King Menander and things like that, they actually still adopted and supported the local culture. But the biggest threat, in fact, came from those from the Arabic Middle Eastern, the Turks, when the Muslims invaded. Eventually, about 10th to 12th century, that was when they took over India, right? And because of that, they essentially created the final straw for the so-called death of Buddhism in India. Right now in India, there's not much Buddhism, but this was its birth country. It's only in the recent about 50 years that there's a gradual revival, but for a whole long period of time, India had no Buddhism left. And the reason why it lost itself was because of a few things. Firstly, it became too scholastic, yeah? And then Tantric Buddhism started to come out, so it merged a fair bit with Brahmanism, started taking a little bit more of those ideas. So its identity between Brahmanism and Buddhism started to become blurred. Yeah? And Buddhism is quite scholastic. If you look at it, it actually has quite a lot of scholasticness in it. If you look at the scriptures, right? Five aggregates, how you break that down, six sense bases, dependent origination, these are not easy concepts to understand. Right? So when India got invaded, right, and the local religions got cleared out, what happened was that Hinduism managed to survive because for them it is a lot to do with still the bhakti part of it, and the sophistication was probably not that strong that it managed to still survive. But Buddhism, when you take away the two big universities that were there, one is Nalanda, you have heard of Nalanda University, there's another university that I only very recently got to know. Anyone knows what's the name of the other big university in India? Two big universities, Nalanda and Vikramasila. You can Google this. Right? These are two big universities of Buddhism in India, whereby a lot of these ideas at the heart of it were actually discussed. But outside of the universities, Buddhism and Brahmanism, Hinduism looks about the same to just a common person. Either I pray to a Buddha or I pray to Vishnu, I'm just praying to someone, right? But it's in a university that there's that sophistication of what does Majjhimika actually think? What does emptiness actually mean? Does it exist or not? And what is consciousness? All those things were done in there, but when the Turks invaded, the Muslims invaded, these were raised to the ground, monks were killed, and everyone scattered. And that was the end of Buddhism in India.
Yeah.
Even before that, during the 7th century onwards, teachers were starting to move away already. Right? Because they see that various different political unsettledness, right? The dynasties, the emperors were pulling back their funding, right? And because they were also having to fight against the invaders, right? Because it took them quite a number of centuries to actually finally penetrate India. Right? During that time, teachers were moving to different areas already. Even around this period of time, Ashoka's period, Buddhism spread towards Sri Lanka, from Sri Lanka to Burma, Thailand. You get the modern day Theravada, right? During this period of time, the Mahayana movement, this is where a lot of teachers went to the north towards Tibet and then northeast towards the China, that area. So this is where Chinese Buddhism has a lot of influence in the Mahayana movement. Yeah? And then the Tantric Buddhism, this is where a lot took root in the Tibetan areas, in the Himalaya regions. Right? So you can see from geographical areas and time period, they spread slightly differently. Right? So if you just want to look at Chinese Buddhism alone, that is another long series, but the heart of it is it came probably around this time. Yeah, when during the rise of the Mahayana, was those ideas got pushed over to China, those areas. Silk Road, from Silk Road into China. Yeah. After a while of time, I can go easily another 2 hours. I will still have something to say about it. But I think this gives you a little bit of the history of how things evolve. Right? Now, all this is just scholarly talk. But when I was reflecting about today's material, I thought, why was it that I was interested? And secondly, what was it that I gained from my understanding of researching all these things? But I say, this is not the actual necessary, the actual truth, so to speak. Right? I like what Barrow Sujato said. He said, possibly between myth and history, the only difference is that myth has magic and history has footnotes. Right? So what he's saying is that maybe history and mythology or legend is hard to sometimes differentiate, despite best efforts. Archaeological stuff, textual analysis, looking at various different things. However, for us as practicing Buddhists, I think there's a few key take-home messages here. For me, firstly is that we need to approach Buddhism with veneration and respect, always, but at the same time, a certain healthy dose of discernment and skepticism, which is, because if you don't, you'll take every single thing as the word. You're not able to question it, and more importantly, you're not able to practice it to see whether this is something that actually works or not. So for me, this is a reason why we understand that what we have today, and this is just until 1000 or 1200. Since then, we've gone so much further, yeah? So more things would have possibly changed. So whenever we see Buddhism right now, still with full veneration that it came from that one teacher, right? We need to also ask a question as to how correct is this, right? So having that sense of a skeptical doubt that's healthy, also discernment. At the same time, it encourages to have humility and not to be too dogmatic about your practice or your belief around Buddhism as well. For me, one thing that struck me time and time again is the humility. It's like, each time I go back to it, I leave with more questions to reflect. It's like, oh, there's this, now this perspective. Now they found these scriptures to say these things. It's like, wow. So there's a sense of humility that probably we won't know. M1 is lost to us, right? But at the same time, there's a sense of we still practice, we still take a practical perspective in the way that we practice the Dharma. At the same time, we also have a sense of humility. Not say that this is the right way, everyone else's Buddhism is wrong. That's probably not healthy because we don't have the full story yet. The third thing I find that's really useful is that we see that sometimes when Buddhism becomes too scholastic and not enough practice and warmth, that's when things happen, right? You see it time and time again. So in our practice, it's important to balance these two aspects. One is trying to really understand the depths of the Buddha's teaching. The other one is to put it into practice. And the third one is to still have that approaching it with certain warmth, not too dry. Yeah, if history teaches us anything, is that when we get too intellectual or become too pedantic about things, that's when problems start to arise too. Yeah. The other thing is, the other take-home message is this. There is truth, which is what the Buddha gave us, but there's power. Right? And there's power versus truth. And sometimes when there's power involved, let's not say anyone else, in our own self, right? When there's personal benefit versus our practice, sometimes that can take over. And that can have repercussions sometimes hundreds and thousands of years down the track. Yeah? And that's something that we have to actually take note of. The other one is masses. Sometimes out of the wanting to convert more, we change the truth. And this is something that, again, could have repercussions hundreds and thousands of years later. So as practicing Buddhists, it's important as best as we can to practice and to be honest about our practice. And not to change that because of power, because of gain, right? Because of wanting to convert other people, right? There's a certain humility and honesty that needs to come with our practice, if history is anything to guide us by. I'll stop at that point. I'll open up for about 4 minutes of questions. Yes?
Do you think that the modern interest, mass interest in mindfulness is another one of these mass movements?
It's a tricky one. Because of mindfulness, there's now arising a branch which is secular Buddhism. Yeah, which is just taking away a lot of the traditional Buddhist stuff and then just looking more at Buddhism as a very secular approach to life, almost kind of psychological. I'm a psychologist in my profession. I can see why that's beneficial, but I agree that sometimes there are risks around that too. And the other one is taking just mindfulness and not the Dharma itself. That is become problematic. But the good thing is that the mindfulness part doesn't say that they are Buddhism. Yeah? They're taking mindfulness and they're saying that this is mindfulness, and mindfulness has become its own brand. As long as mindfulness doesn't equal Buddhism, I think that's still okay. It is when mindfulness equals Buddhism, that's when I think we've really lost the plot. Like, a large richness with saying that this represents the whole of Buddhism, that's going to be problematic. So it's yet to be seen. So does that answer your question? Yeah, that's my perspective anyway. So we've yet to be seen. Maybe a few thousand years time, we'll be like, oh, that was bad.
Yeah, other questions?
Jihong, I was very interested to know a bit more about Buddhism in China.
Yes.
Certain times it was very secular, but towards the modern China, is it still as popular or is it diminishing?
Right now it's getting popular.
As a traveler, I see a lot more temples and more people going to the temple and pray.
Yeah.
But then the more younger generation, they don't seem to follow. I don't know if there are enough of young Chinese here, so I don't know.
I think
today's Buddhism in China, like,
you can look at Buddhism. This is one of the books that I find is quite interesting, although it's one perspective. This is by a history professor, I think. Yeah, professor of religion, Noble Ross Reed. It goes through Buddhism in India, it goes through Buddhism in Tibet, in China, in Sri Lanka, in Thailand. And then if anyone who starts off with the notion that there's not a single drop of blood spilled in the name of Buddhism, I challenge you to read this book and let's have some humility around that. Right? Because you just look at history and like, oh, we have done much wrong too, yeah? Yeah? Going back to the question about China, I think the whole issue with the vacuum of the Cultural Revolution and now the reopening and re-engaging with old ideas, Buddhism is starting to revive in China. But what form of Buddhism is still yet to be seen. Yeah, because there's still a lot of not even Tantric Buddhism, but everyday bhakti, compassion based. Some of these ones are starting to come up. This one at least has some philosophical, theoretical rigor. Yeah, but there's a lot of still kind of more devotional practices that are emerging. But the good thing is that they're starting to get teachers in also from other places to start to plant those seeds again. I think it's still very early days. I think there's a vacuum in terms of the understanding of the Dhamma at this stage. Yeah. Yes?
Can you mention how Zen arose?
Zen comes up from, depending on which school of Zen, yeah, Zen in fact started from Chinese Buddhism with the Chan Buddhism. It's the same word, right? The character-wise, it's the same character, right? Right? For me, this is Chinese, it's called Chan. In Japanese, this character is called Zen. So this comes from meditative practices. Now, the Zen depends on what type of school it comes from, right? And within that, it's like, it is Zen, some of the Zen teachings emphasize a lot of emptiness, yeah? Some emphasize on recognizing what's the true sense of your heart and your consciousness. So you can see the influences within that is also different. So I'll say that, actually, I best make this clear. No matter is Zen, is Mahayana, is Tantric Buddhism, all of them have a direct connection with the Buddha. Yeah? So it's how strong the connection is. So in Zen also, depending on which school of Zen, some are closer to understanding five aggregate six sense spaces, some are more into the emptiness, some are more into recognizing the nature of consciousness. So that is an expansion, I think, if you're looking for Chan and Zen Buddhism, very much influenced, I think, by the Mahayanist movement. Yeah. Other questions? Yes?
Because of the lineage of Theravada,
yeah,
would you say that that it perhaps retains more of the original features of early Buddhism?
One of the things that I encourage people to do is, when you look at Buddhist scriptures of a particular school, look at that Buddhist scripture, and look at a different school, look at a different school, look at a different school, and you find where they intersect. Yeah? Theravada seems to have less added, but there's still stuff that's changed. Yeah? Compared to some of the Mahayana schools, probably they've got more of the other stuff. So based on just the collection of the scripture itself, scholars tend to agree that what we have in the modern day Theravadan canon is probably quite close to M1, but it's still not exactly it. It's already an embellished version of M1. In the Chinese Buddhism school, like I say, in current modern day Chinese Buddhism school, the Tripitaka in Chinese Buddhism has got the Mahayana scriptures and also has got a group of scripture called the Agamas. Right? 5 volumes in there, or 4 depending on how which categorization. These actually come from one of the sects within here. It's the Savastivada sect. So for somehow they ended up in that collection that we have, the only surviving, we don't have the Sanskrit version. It most probably was Sanskrit before it got translated into Chinese, but we lost the Sanskrit version. There's the Chinese version there. Now they're still discovering some of the Agama texts that's in Tibetan language. So it's still unfolding. Yeah? So this is where you find this part that's actually here. Or at least suggest that it's actually there. And this is probably closest to the M1 as we can get right now. Unless for some reason we can reverse time and go back to ask the Buddha, what was it that recorded? Right? Pending that, I think from the scholarly understanding, Theravadan context has a large chunk that is closest to that, and the various different schools all have that, but to varying different degrees. So one of the ways that I find is that if a scripture repeatedly comes up in different schools, then most probably that's correct. But some school have it, some school don't, then we are a little bit unsure about that. Yeah. Even within Mahayana, some schools within Mahayana Buddhism have certain scriptures that other Mahayana schools don't have. Right? So within that, you just have to keep trying to, it's like panning for gold, right? You kind of keep panning, you get small little specks, right? So it's a bit like that, and this is all the scholarly work that's happened. It's still ongoing right now. Because of technology, we're able to start doing it right now. Yeah, even 50 years ago, without internet and things like that, we're not able to actually collaborate that much. But now that scholars are starting to be able to come together, plus the archaeological digging and stuff like that is still occurring. Yeah. Time-wise, I think we should leave it. Like I said, this is not a simple topic. And the reason why that we don't often cover it is because there's no necessary consensus, right? There's a lot of still question marks. There are more question marks than there are answers at this stage. But I think there's enough to teach us the lessons that I've outlined here. Right, in terms of how we approach the practice, how we balance the practice, how we try to stay true as much as possible to our practice, and be aware of things like power, things like having reach, right, influence, right, and also as Buddhists, to try to keep chasing back to what the Buddha's message was originally was. So I'll leave it at that. Right. Thank you, everyone.